Preface. I'm writing this preface retrospectively on New Year's Day, just before I open the folder that holds the files that my book will comprise. This series of personal essays I wrote during a one-month window this past fall, thus the title, starting late October and running until late November. It was a warm, spectacular fall this year, courtesy of El Niño, the ongoingly pleasant days just perfect for a splendorous leaf fall. I've always loved that time of year, every day such a dramatic change from the day preceding, as if time is accelerated, trying to close down the show before Thanksgiving gets here, nature finally revealing, rapid fire, all the glitzy layers it kept under wraps in the heat of the summer, like some mega stage magic show. The pace, breathtaking. As you will find out soon, I walk in the woods every day, usually in the morning for an hour or so, as my wife Carol and I did for years before she passed away last winter. We used to have on those walks wonderfully circuitous conversations about anything and everything, all rolled up together, day after day, completely unscripted, always surprising, like elaborate mazes we navigated to pass the time pleasingly together while we walked. We would wonder from time to time what it might be like if we tried to write them down, these meandering, vivid riffs on life, love, time, death, all of it. But, like dreams, about a minute after we got back to the workaday world, they were wiped clean, receding simply into our nervous systems as a gathering residue of embodied wisdom, or wackiness, which are, we both agreed, right next to each other, sometimes even simultaneous, on the tachometer, of human understanding. These walks and these talks somehow kept us grounded, steady, ready together to take on what we had to take on to make a way in the world where normal, or at least a convincing simulation of it, is often obligatory. I was in a state of great agitation this fall, all kinds of loose threads flipping around looking for a pattern to turn into, my trying to figure out how to live now that I'm alone. Carol was not there to talk to about this, so I talked to myself in the one place I knew would let me do that without inhibition. In the woods, with the things that had always seemed eager and able to listen to us daily, which is what I needed, what anyone needs when the stakes are so high, the entanglements so baffling. All these trees, such good company, so smart, so sweet, so beautiful, like my wife. I had no plan for each day and no plan for the series that emerged from the amalgam of that month. Basically, I'd just start walking, see something out there that would trigger something in here, then on and on until it ended. I'd try, while I walked, keep enough of an inventory so I could write down at least some of it when I got home, which is what I did, day by day by day, 3, 6, 9 pages each sitting, typing as fast as I could, then dropping it, unreread, into the electronic folder, so I could make breakfast and get on with my quotidian affairs. I'm about to open that folder to see what I have. I hope it is as fulsome as all those days, what I saw, what I thought about, ravaged and ravished by turns, over what I have lost, what was falling all around me, dazzlingly, crazily, and that it may take me, after this long winter maybe, to meet who I am to become, just up ahead there on the path, waiting. There are, I now see, 22 essays here, ranging in length from 2 to 18 pages, though most are 6 to 8 pages or so, easily negotiable in a brief sitting. There is a weak narrative line among them, some back references, that kind of thing, but no plot, so you don't have to read them in sequence. You can, if you prefer, just dip in somewhere, read until it's too boring or depressing, jump to a new spot, or wait for another time when you can start somewhere else that strikes your fancy doing the same thing. That is actually one of my favorite modes of reading, especially poetic texts, and this book strives to have that aspect. Just open a book to a page, glance around, a few glimpses, flip to another, getting a sense of rhythm, style, flow, then backwards, forwards, whatever. I often read poems that way, the first time through, from the inside out. Sometimes I even read sentences that way. As I write about it now, it sounds more like how you look at a painting. You don't start at the top left corner and process the pixels in sequence. Your eye lights somewhere, moves, aggregates perceptions, revises, moves, reaches, etc. You get the whole thing, just along a less predictable and more instinctive path. In any case, all of this is to say that I hope you will stay with the parts your eye can't look away from and slip away whenever it gets too dark or too meandery. Carol died sometime during the afternoon of February 17th. No one can say exactly when, while I was at work. I found her when I got home. My life stopped dead right then. When I described my odd, out-of-body feelings last spring, I said that time, for me, had halted and hadn't started up again yet. But that was, I see now, came to see through the series of walks I write about in what follows here, while true, just one symptom, among others, of this larger crisis. Time, I have no doubt, and many philosophers and poets agree, is the primary criterion that defines life for us in this particular world. It is what orchestrates the glories and horrors of our journey here, defines all the binaries we take for granted in the organizational paradigm of our this worldly experience, the ones that seem to me now to be right on top of each other, always co-present. And when our life here is over, time is, I believe, something from which we will be set free. As I say in a poem I wrote about 25 years ago after my mother-in-law's former lover took his life, I wonder how long it is after the last breath before time evaporates, the past, the future, all of it, just a ball of smoke caught in the throat, one small cough, and it mingles with infinity. None of us ever lives in the moment, except maybe at the passing of that last breath, past and future colliding finally at the only point they will ever have in common. Between February and November, I resided in a strange netherworld that is neither of this world nor of the next, whatever that might be. As I explained to a friend at a restaurant a few weeks after Carol died, I felt as if I were watching myself, my old self, on TV in a series populated by all the characters I knew for whom the ongoing narrative went on normally. But the real me was now outside the plane of that reality, simply a viewer. My character in the program, I could see, was not a very good actor, forgetting his lines, mucking up the storyline. The writers would have to get him out of the script soon. The me watching, on the other hand, was on fire, full more of rage than of words, that feeble currency of human experience. But like most of us when we watch TV, so captivated by those moving pixels without an identity of his own. And the rest of the cast was, of course, as oblivious to him as characters on TV are of us, sitting in our living rooms watching them. I had some strange powers of perception during that interim, simultaneously awesome and creepy. They diminished gradually over the months. Now they are mostly gone, for which I am grateful. You can't make a life in this world if you are not in it. Time started up for me with a gentle click on one of my final walks this fall. I felt it. I know exactly where and when it happened. I realized right then that I was coming to life again, like a newborn plopping down right on that path in the woods, inhaling air, wailing. I later calculated that it was almost exactly 9 months since Carol had died. I write about this in one of the essays that follows. Now I'm here again and need to figure out what I can do with the time I will still spend here. This preface is a good example of how the following pieces move and why they have been so functional for me. Writing, for me, is and always has been a future-oriented instrument. A lot of conventional ways of teaching writing imply the opposite, that it is a way to record and render a quantum of knowledge one has already acquired and formatted. In other words, it reaches back and extends the past. I almost never write that way. I begin in confusion, wonder, hope, dismay, whatever. I find some words to start with. Then I type and think, or think and type at almost exactly the same time. Like that sentence I just wrote. I had no idea I was about to say that until it came out. If I hadn't liked it, or don't further down the line, I will excise it or revise it. But even if I do, the future that sentence oriented toward me is here. I'm seeing now, having written that, like a flash of insight, both how and why people who have been shocked out of themselves by life events are drawn toward the arts, writing, painting, music, to recover. These media help to elicit, out of almost nothing, a possible future. I guess this is to say that what follows here is very self-serving. I hope that will not make you stop reading, that I will be able to make some of this interesting and useful enough for you to keep going, or coming back, to give it a chance. Maybe I shouldn't have said what I said these last few paragraphs, but really, I couldn't help it. As I tell people over and over, the only things that come out of me now are exactly what I am thinking, right then. I can't fake it or even tweak it. I can only speak it or not speak it. So, if I'm to have a book for you to read, I can't not write it. I'm about to start my sabbatical, that scheduled respite professors earn every 6 years. In practical terms, that means I am free from my teaching responsibilities until next September, 8 months from now. At one time, I'm sure, given the name of these interludes, rooted in Sabbath, the day of rest, the expectation was that all work would be suspended to promote reflection, emotional restoration, intellectual invigoration, such that the person returning to the classroom would be reanimated, more dynamic. Now, in the contemporary academy, it's more a time of tacit pressure to finish a book or start a new one, research being the be-all, end-all of academic culture. That is, the period of rest is not now intended to make you a better teacher. It is designed to relieve you of the burden of teaching in order to do your real work, which is not writing and thinking per se, but publishing. That may sound cynically reductive, but I don't mean it that way. It's just an honest appraisal of what work in my profession happens to be about now. I've adapted myself to that culture as best I could and been quite successful on its terms. My great good fortune at this stage of my career, so close to retirement, is that the economic impetus I have previously felt toward publication, to keep my job, get promoted, get a better raise, etc., a significant impetus to be sure, is now gone. I don't need to worry about that any longer. A great relief. Whatever I write now can go online when it's ready and stay there until I take it down. All as free as I can make it. I had a number of other, to me, very good reasons for short-circuiting the publishing process in this way, but that was the main one. I did not want the profanity of money intervening too heavily on either side of the transaction for this book, so deeply personal to me, either payment to read it or profit potential, and everything that issues from that for a publisher. Period. The fact that making it available this way will be the equivalent, from the Academy's point of view, of never having written it in the first place, is of no consequence to me whatsoever. And paradoxically, If I do it well, my work on this book will be the very rest I need to come back renewed, not to teaching, but to life, a life, my life, whatever it's meant to be. My brother and his wife stopped by a few days ago for an overnight stay on their way back to New Jersey from a visit with their son in Chicago. It's entirely possible that that will have been the last sustained encounter I have with people who love me until I fly out to Washington for my daughter's wedding in April. I'm surprised by my response to writing that sentence. It doesn't upset or unnerve me in the least. Carol was my world. She truly loved me every single day. Now she's gone. I understand that I have been irrational, running amok in my attempts to find some semblance of that in the interim. I knew how stupid that was while I was doing it. But recognizing stupidity and stopping it are two different things, as the whole of human history, including my own, amply demonstrates. It's time for me now to take my time. There are a number of terms that cross my mind to describe this upcoming interlude. Pure solitude was a phrase I used with one friend. A sort of romantic, self-induced separation from society that allows for meditation, reflection, emergent self-understanding. Seclusion, as in going into it, is another term that comes to mind. That conscious choice anyone can make to get off the main track and onto a sideline for a while, as a way to rest, recover. Isolation is another, in the sense of an enforced separation via confinement from society, like a prisoner kept apart from the general population, a way to do time. My isolation will certainly not be hard time. I'm actually free, radically free, to do, think, say anything I want. I know I have work to do to overcome the effects of my loss. I've done time before, not on this scale, but for analogous reasons, so it's not a new thing. Thinking of this time that way, as something I am about to do, actually makes it look sweet, appealing, inviting me to use it wisely, toward rehabilitation, rather than the kind of chronic recidivism that results when the future is forever resisted or declined. So, sabbatical, my month of Sundays, times 8. I hope I will use these days respectfully, make something of them, from them. Come to terms, not with death, whoever does that, but with life, what's left of mine. Solitude, seclusion, isolation, just me with me, starts right now.